Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. A school and community partnership in the Cook Islands wants to change its young people's mindset as a way of combating non-communicable diseases in the country. According to the health minister, one in three adults in Cook Islands suffer from NCDs, or so-called lifestyle diseases. Indira Stewart has more.
The country's education and health ministry teamed up with the Liggins Institute at the University of Auckland over the past 3 years to develop a science and health project involving Nukutere, Titikaveka and Te Reora colleges. Karen Tairea from the health ministry says targeting the youth may be the key to fighting the NCD epidemic.
I think we've almost given up on the adult population, because their habits are so ingrained, but we're hoping to, through this program, is to get the younger lot thinking a lot more about their behaviours and the impact that it has on their health so that they can make the right choices. But it's not just that. It's them taking the message home to their family.
Te Reora College Principal Tanya Morgan agrees and says the students aren't the only ones who've been reached by the project.
It certainly raised the awareness, not just amongst the students, but the staff and our wider community as well. So in terms of that, that's been a real positive for us.
The project incorporated issues relating to NCDs through various parts of the school's curricula and encouraged students to explore the impacts NCDs had in their families and communities. Jackie Bay from the Liggins Institute says the project was eye-opening for students.
They're telling us that until they saw the data, because the learning resources are actually getting the kids to explore the data about NCDs in their community and internationally, and they said, until we saw the data, we didn't believe it. And then they talk about the fact that that allowed them to take the conversations around the dinner table at home.
More than 50 educators, health professionals and community leaders are meeting this week in Rarotonga to discuss how the pilot project could be extended throughout the country. Ms Bay hopes the project can be established throughout the region.
One of the things that we've done is build the learning modules so that we have identified stories that any of the countries in the region could pick up. And we've also used a lot of regional-wide evidence for the kids to explore and then to look at that within their own context. We think that there's a lot of potential for other countries to particularly pick up and look at what's been going on in the Cook Islands.
Jackie Bay says a similar project is currently being run in Tonga. This is Indira Stewart.
An internal investigation is underway in Solomon Islands after several buildings burned down at the Gizo Hospital in the Western Province. The country's second largest hospital lost an entire supply of medicines and cleaning supplies in a fire last month as well. All of the accounting records and kitchen and laundry facilities. Police have arrested a psychiatric patient who is alleged to have caused the fire. The provincial health director, Dick Bora, says he also launched his own investigation into the incident. But he will not say whether or not he has reason to believe there has been negligence or professional misconduct. He spoke to Karori Hawkins.
We're trying to just focus on some key services, areas of the administration, especially the accounts and the finance, to get it, the health service needed that most. So we managed to move them to the new complex as we find a small space. But there's four departments, public health departments, which we still need to find office space just for them to, provide service to the public. But we almost all the units and departments destroyed by the fire, we managed to find a temporary space for them at the hospital, and also we utilizing some private spaces around the town to sort of just house try to get some of the public health services off the ground.
Yes, and in terms of the psychiatric patient who is alleged to have caused the fire, is he in custody? He can't be charged, right, under the country's laws?
No, you cannot charge him. I think it's in the hands of the local police I think we cannot place charges because he's a patient. I think the local police will have more insight of how the legal side of it. But we won't be pressing charges for that patient.
Are you doing any internal investigations in terms of negligence or patient care?
Yeah, I think we I'm doing a, it's sort of not an in official investigation, but you know, just finding out stories from staff who are involved, and but we will have a you know, proper report on that incident probably as next week. So yeah, we are doing our investigation as well, but the police are doing their investigation into this issue as well. So I think that's all I can say about that one.
Yes. Do you anticipate any heads rolling, terminations as a result of those, your own investigations?
I'm not sure, actually. Not sure. Maybe from the investigation, I think my report will just go straight to the Ministry of Health at the national level, and probably the decision of any other decision other than that will come from the Ministry of Health.
A Pacific academic says research needs to contribute to community development in the Pacific instead of catering to funding requirements. The director of the Pacific Research and Policy Center at New Zealand's Massey University, Malakehiti Kalosokomi, says plenty of research is going on, but the practical dimensions are often ignored in favor of securing funding. He told Daniela Makodi-Cox, more governance is needed for the Pacific research agenda.
People tend to work in silos and compartments, so there needs to be a greater collaboration beyond and across borders. And that's, I think that's how you build up the critical mass and the capacity to obviously to create, you know, and construct more knowledge, but also, of course, to attract the, you know, the funding. Because the problem is people will fund certain things and not others. And I'm afraid that it's sometimes they fund the wrong things. Well, not the wrong things, but they fund the things that are not, well, that are less important for community development.
Would it be beneficial to have one organization that handled research in the Pacific, or would that just create another bureaucratic step that could slow it down?
There is one, of course. There is the New Zealand Institute for Pacific Research. But again, that's, you know, it's government control, and you know, the research agenda is largely set by government. Although I think there is some academic freedom for the institute to seek other areas to do research. But, you know, at the end of the day, the government will fund certain things and it won't fund others. So it's difficult to try and get the all-important research dollar to follow what's important for the Pacific.
What's the solution to satisfying those who control the money for the research and also satisfying the research that is needed?
Yeah, I know. I think that's a very important question and a difficult one too. I think there needs to be a body, whether it's an institute or whether it's a part of a university, that caters for a Pacific group. That doesn't mean, of course, that non-Pacific are not included. I'm saying that group or the unit or the institution should focus on specific research. The other thing is, of course, is that the government, the Indian government and other governments and other funding bodies need also to be a part of the discussion with that group, because it gives integrity and or it gives freedom to their research, and it gives them some leeway and not to worry about funding dollar, the research funding that all researchers want.
Is that research centre in Auckland not meeting those requirements?
Yes and no. I'm guessing that the government is has got its own agenda, and that it wants certain things to be researched, and it's tagging money to those objectives. And of course, you know, the government is free to do whatever it likes, and then it gives that agenda to the Institute of Pacific Research. But then, of course, there's no reason why the institute cannot go beyond the parameters set by the government. But, you know, at the end of the day, the research will follow the funding. So what I'm saying is give Pacific and non-Pacific researchers an opportunity to come together and to decide on the agenda, and then give it the money to research in those areas where they think it's important. At the moment, research is being driven politically, and that's not healthy.
A Chinese mining company has given the green light to resume its Papua New Guinea operations in both mining and logging. Rumuniko, a subsidiary of the China Metallurgical Group Corporation, operates one of PNG's major resources projects, the Ramu Nickel Mine in Mandang Province. It also is the only mining company in PNG involved in logging. As Johnny Blades explains, both mining and logging activities were shut down following labor accidents.
Yes, so Ramu Nickel's logging activities, which are located around the Kurumbakari mine site, were ordered to a halt last August by authorities following a fatality of a logging worker. Similarly, the Ramu Nickel Mine operations were suspended in April this year after an incident which resulted in the death of a Chinese national employee and injuries to two local workers. Since then, PNG's Mineral Resources Authority carried out investigations into the respective situations, particularly reviews of the standards around health and safety of workers, and in the past few weeks permission has been given for both logging and mining activities to resume, which will be pleasing for the company.
Now, this wasn't the first accident or death involving Ramu Nickel, was it?
There have been quite a few incidents. I mean, at the start of this year, the PNG government reported that a CEPIC worker had been killed at the mine. And right back when the project was being developed, about 7 years ago, the death of a local worker triggered clashes between PNG workers and the Chinese management at the mine. But then 2 years ago, a group of locals, including a couple of employees with the Ramu Nickel Project, launched an attack on property at the mine, as well as injured five Chinese workers. There does seem to be a history of resentment at the Chinese developer, because the developer has in many instances brought in Chinese nationals to do the work. People resent that. And right from the beginning of the mine project, it caught the attention of labour and industrial relations officials, who were concerned about the parlous working conditions there. So the labour standards of the Ramu Nickel's logging activities appear to have followed the same tone of the mining.
And in March of this year, I understand that a slurry pipeline at the mining project had leaked. That doesn't sound very good.
But the company was quick to assure that there was no acid in the stuff that streamed out. But, you know, the claims by Ramu Nickel a few years ago that its pipes were unbreakable now sound rather hollow. You know, things haven't really gone smoothly in this major project. In addition to all this, around 600 workers at the mine went on strike this January over mine management issues. Let's not forget that locally, disquiet over the project's mine tailings pipeline lingers. You know, that's the pipeline which dumps mine waste into the sea off Bazamuk Bay in Madang. And that was, of course, the subject of a long-running but ultimately unsuccessful legal challenge by landowners. But following the death and injuries at the mine in April, which happened around a high-pressure acid leach, Mining Minister Byron Chan blamed the incident, at least partly, on the company's cost-cutting measures. You know, this company, like others in the industry, it's been struggling with the slump in global commodity prices. So all these things cast further doubt on the Ramu Nickel developer's adherence to safety and industrial standards.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The chair of the Nuclear Veterans Association in French Polynesia says the admission by France's former prime minister that nuclear testing had a detrimental effect is a welcome step. However, Roland Oldham says he will wait to see if anything comes from it, as he's used to politicians not following through. Last week, Alain Juppé, who was the prime minister from 1995 to 1997 when nuclear testing was controversially resumed, conceded that the tests harmed the environment and people's health. It took Paris until 2009 to admit that nuclear testing wasn't clean, which he says was wrong. Mr. Juppé is seeking the French presidency next year and also promised to revisit compensation laws for those affected. But Roland Oldham, who is the chair of the Marutopusan Committee, told Jamie Tahanaha that promises have been made but have never been kept.
His visit is propaganda as a candidate for the next election of the president of the French Republic. He wanted to meet us, to meet the anti-nuclear and organization of the victim. And so we had a meeting with him.
Well, I guess it's significant because he was the Prime Minister under Jacques Chirac when France resumed nuclear testing in the 1990s. What did he have to say about that? He made quite a big admission too that it did have harmful effects.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of some kind of a suicide operation as someone that had played an important role in the nuclear testing. He recognized the mistake that they had made. That's what he said. And he insists on the fact that today that we all know that he said that himself, that the French nuclear test has not been clean, as they were saying for many, many years. But as far as we're concerned, that's one thing. That's great. But that's not the most important thing to us. For us, the most important thing, what they're going to do, what sort of action they're going to do to solve the problem of compensation. And we also say very clearly, it is important for us that they ask the Polynesian people, the Maori people, for forgiveness. Because as far as we are concerned, the nuclear tests in our country have been something that have been forced onto us, and to us it is a terrorist act.
Did he suggest that he would do that if elected? He did pledge to look at compensation.
Well, as far as compensation, he made promise that it's going to be some compensation. But once again, as I say, we don't stop on promises as we wait for real action. So that's where we stand.
François Hollande, the current president, when he visited in February, I think it was, he pledged to revisit the compensation too, and so far nothing's really happened. Now we've got Alain Juppé saying the same. There probably will be other candidates who will come by. How much do you put in these promises they're making? Because they have been made before, haven't they?
Well, the promises they made before, we have that experience. Hollande is not the first one. There have been some before. Sarkozy also had promised that he recognized the damage that had been done to this country, but have done nothing. Hollande came around, and for someone that had made promises twice and had not been able to keep his promises, I think that's very sad. We don't believe in promise. We will only believe in act.
That was the chair of a Nuclear Veterans Association in French Polynesia, Roland Oldham.
A Samoan family in New Zealand is furious at the lack of progress on a legal case that went to the Supreme Court 13 years ago. A now elderly and unwell woman, Kirita Maria Kolotati Pun of Auckland, New Karatepuna, and her family in 2003 went to court in Samoa to contest the transfer of title made by her elderly father 8 years ago. She contends that her bedridden, blind, and senile father was not able to make a decision without legal advice to transfer the titles of the land in Apia to her brother. Miss Puni contends the transfer of land, now gone to be worth several million dollars, was fraudulent. The brother and father have been dead for many years, and the land has since changed hands and has been developed further. But Miss Pune is still to hear about the outcome of her 2003 legal case. Although she revised a brief note from the Supreme Court 2 years ago with an interim decision saying the matter was fraudulent, but the court wasn't ready to make a decision. The case has been taken up by Miss Puma's daughter Clara, who has also run into issues with lawyers in Samoa who say she is suing separately. For the past 2 years, she's had an Auckland-based lawyer, Luelia Olinda Woodruff, in her corner, and she explained more about this complex case to Don Wiseman.
The dispute is that the old man that you're speaking about, who was over 90 at the time, his son, who was a member of parliament, appeared to have somehow got father to sign a document that gave him the right to the parents' property. And the old man had a daughter who is now my client. The daughter is well over 70 and quite ill in New Zealand.
What we're talking about here is the deeds of conveyance, is that right?
Yes, it's more than the deed of conveyance. It's the fact, how can a man who was critically ill at the time, 91 years old. How could he sign documents without legal advice or without somebody with a medical knowledge to advise whether he had full mental capacity? There was a lot of issues surrounding the signing over to the MP. And what he did was then he used the estate to finance a business.
It's not just any land, is it? It's two very interesting pockets of highly valuable commercial land in Apia worth together several millions of dollars.
Yes, that's right.
In 2003, the mother took her brother to court in Apia.
Yes.
And ever since, the family's been waiting for a decision on what is essentially a question over father's will in the end, isn't it? Because he died soon after.
Yes, that's
and
right.
There hasn't been a decision. It's now 13 years until, I think you came on, as you say, as the lawyer just 2 years ago, and soon after that, you received an interim decision from the Supreme Court Justice saying that there was some fraudulent activity involved, but he wasn't taking it further at that stage because he was looking at some other matters to do with mortgages on the property. And another 2 years have passed and nothing's happened. It's a real mystery, isn't it?
Yes, it is a mystery. And yes, you were correct in your statement earlier. This involved two very, very expensive pieces of freehold land, not traditional land. And one is right in the midst of Apia, of the town. So it's a very valuable piece of land. And that is the land that ultimately was sold by a law firm who were acting for one of the companies or people who were dealing with the man who borrowed the money, you know, the brother. But suffice to say, yes, I came in 2014. I took every step that possible to ask His Honour Chief Justice for a decision because I wanted to focus. The family have already spent a lot of money on lawyers. I wanted to focus my drive into getting finality. I asked His Honour, is there a decision? And if it's not, perhaps it might be appropriate for Your Honour to recuse yourself. Because I needed finality for this woman. She's not well, and she's well in her 70s.
Why should he recuse himself?
Because every time I ask the question in the court, I don't get what I'm seeking. I normally put a memorandum in, the same as I do with the High Court in New Zealand, but I've never had a satisfactory response. So in the end, I thought, well, if His Honour was not doing his duty, it may be appropriate that he recuse himself and get somebody else to look at the situation. I cannot just continually use a client's money to keep making memorandums with no result.
Clearly that didn't work because you got effectively ordered out of Samoa, didn't you? Although you were Samoan and you have been admitted to the Samoan bar as well as the New Zealand bar, but they say that you can't practice there, at least on this case. What do you make of all of that?
Well, suddenly now I've lost my right to citizenship under the constitution of the country. And suffice to say, I will not back off because nobody will take away my right. But the point is that the Law Society then passed the law to classify me as a non-resident person, even though I am a citizen of the country and even though I've actually practiced law in Samoa for 21 years and I have personal properties there.
But you're not resident, are you?
It depends on what the definition of resident. Resident in the Legal Act is actually I qualified. And I've sought opinions of two Queen's Councils in New Zealand. Their interpretation of residence and mine fit the mould. I shouldn't be treated like an outsider.
We've had this 13-year delay on what sounds like it should have been an easy decision to make, coloured by the fact that there was very large amounts of money involved.
Yes.
No decision in 13 years. What's going on?
Can you answer that question? I certainly can't because there's an issue that there was a member of parliament was the party that was sued by the lady that I now act for. There could be something to do with that. It was a government organisation that lent the MP some money. So is it something to do with that? I also then found it's a ministry of the Samoa government where I found that, in my opinion, they used the wrong part of the law to actually pursue the selling of the property despite the fact that there was a court order not to sell the properties in the interim. So there's a lot of questions, unanswered questions with this case.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I just want to tell you that if you are listening to this program at 22 hours UTC on Fridays on 9955 kilohertz, we do have a special EQSL for the program. Again, that's it for our transmission at 22 hours UTC for the Caribbean, Latin America, and South America on 9955 kilohertz. You can send that along to focus@pcjmedia.com along with your comments and questions. If you want to listen to this program again or subscribe to it as a podcast on your iPhone or other mobile device, just go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the link for Focus Asia Pacific and you'll find all the details there. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah.